Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Season 9 of The Dark Mummy Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Time for part two of our series on fraud, Graham.
Yes, Ray, part one seems to have been very popular, hopefully for the right reasons.
Well, quite so, Graham. I dare say there's the old villain listening to this and learning their trade, courtesy of our podcast. There's not much we can do about that, Graham. If some people choose to use our podcast as a guide to criminality, we can only hope that for every one of them, there are five or six others using it to help in the prevention, detection and reporting of that criminality.
Well, exactly, Ray. So moving on, in part one, we gave a general introduction to the world of fraud. And now in part two, we want to dig a bit deeper.
Indeed. Over the next 15, 20 minutes or so, we want to explain in general terms some of the more common types of fraud and hopefully how to avoid falling for them.
Yes, and if we just save a handful of people from falling foul of the fraudsters, it will have all been worthwhile.
It's easy for you to say. and it's nice to have another opportunity for a bit of the now legendary Dark Money Files alliteration.
We never mind a bit of alliteration, Ray, do we?
Always up for that, Graham. And while we're on that subject, we should maybe start with authorised push payment fraud.
Well, yes, and sadly, one of the most common and probably one of the most effective frauds there are out there.
Yeah, so we alluded to this last week, but let's break those three words down first. Authorised?
Yeah, meaning this is not done behind the victim's back. The victim is actually persuaded to agree to it.
Mm. Push?
Yep, that's the money isn't sucked out of your account, but money that you willingly, but unwittingly, send to the fraudsters.
Payment, I suspect, is reasonably obvious.
Well, yes, indeed. I think it probably is. But we should talk about how the fraudsters make this happen.
Yes, we should. Now, most of them fall under the broad category of social engineering or psychological manipulation, right?
They do indeed, which effectively boils down to two different responses, avoiding pain or feeling good.
Exactly. So if you don't do this, you might lose all of your money.
Yeah. Ouch. Or if you do this, you will be helping someone so much worse off than you, or maybe just improving your own life immeasurably. Mm. When I say immeasurably, I'm not suggesting that you improve it in a manner that you would measure. we might return to that theme later when we talk about spam.
Oh dear. Right, okay. It sounds deeply unsavory.
Yeah.
Well, I hesitate to say it, Graham, but let's put a little more meat on the bones, shall we?
Excellent.
The first one is possibly the most common, and that's where you get a call to tell you your account has been compromised and you need to move your money to a new account.
Yeah, whereas if your account really had been compromised, a simple thing to do would be to change the password, which oddly enough, Ray, happened to my Microsoft account last week. Somebody, not me, tried to log in from the USA. Definitely not me. But I got a verified email from Microsoft and telling me somebody had tried to log in. So I logged in using my two-factor authentication, so I knew it really was my Microsoft account. And I changed the password straight away. Job done.
Well, that's all true. But the scammers aren't really targeting people like us who kind of know what we're doing tech-wise, are they? Although we will share an example later of where this can really hit even quite tech-savvy people.
Well, we will, but I think it's an important point, and it's a sad thing about this, that they're not on the lookout for people like you and me. They are really on the lookout for vulnerable people who are both less comfortable with the tech and more likely to believe the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way these things work generally, isn't it? It's like phishing emails. They seem completely obvious to most people, but that's how they filter out the ones who aren't worth the effort.
You are spot on, Ray. And even those who take some measures to protect themselves, for example, by insisting on calling, say, a spammer back on the bank's fraud number, they're often fooled because the scammers don't hang up. They just play a dial tone to make it sound like they have. And when the mark calls back, they answer as if they were the correct people to speak to.
And as you say, there's a wide variety of APP scams. But what about some of the others?
Well, I thought we'd have a talk about tab napping.
Well, yeah, why not? Tab napping is a great name, isn't it?
It really is. So, Ray, do you want to explain what tab napping is?
Well, I will. We saw a demonstration of this when we were in Israel, didn't we?
Well, yes, we did. And I have to say it was in equal measures fascinating and deeply scary.
Yeah, so let's see why. Tab napping is a method of using a programming language called JavaScript. Did you see how I tried to sound like I knew what I was talking about there?
I'm totally convinced.
Yeah, marvellous. To change the contents of an open but inactive tab to make it look like the logon screen of your bank instead of whatever was there before.
Now, presumably, that's only possible if the people who are doing this have previously embedded some sort of malware or other code on your computer.
Well, exactly. Keeping your antivirus and malware software up to date is pretty important to prevent this kind of attack.
Yeah, absolutely. But so, if they're doing this, having changed the look of this open but now dormant tab, what happens next?
Well, when you go to that tab, you assume that you've been logged out by your bank or whatever, and one of two things happens. You either close the tab and no harm's done, or you try and log in, and by doing so, you give away your login details because the tab's being mirrored on someone else's computer a long way away, potentially.
Okay, and when you then try and log in...
Well, you'll.
On this.
Yeah, well, I mean, you won't actually be logging in, obviously, to your bank account, but you'll get some sort of innocuous looking message like, there's been an issue logging you in. Please close your browser and try again.
And frankly, you'd be none the wiser, would you?
Well, exactly. Now, if you're using two-factor authentication, the likelihood is that no harm will be done because you'd need the second element to log in, and so would the bad guys. But, as above, the scammers are looking for the vulnerable members of society who tend to avoid the more complex method of logging in because they find them confusing or, you know, they get in the way of their flow, whatever. And in turn, that's going to make them even more vulnerable.
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah.
So, and actually, leading on from that, one of the most insidious frauds is actually known as fraud recovery fraud.
Yeah, which sounds a bit tautologous.
Well, it does a bit, but the way it works is both simple and just massively immoral.
Okay, tell us more.
Well, it's a fraud perpetrated on people who've already been the victim of one fraud. Back in the day, when I was heading up the complex case investigations team for one of our high street banks, we uncovered a pretty sophisticated carbon credit scam.
Oh, now that's where people were persuaded to invest in so-called carbon credits as part of a green investment scheme, only to find out that they'd been sold worthless investments that have got virtually no realisable value.
Exactly. Mm. And just when people are about to write off their entire investment, they are contacted by someone who says they've got the ability to get their money back. But in order to do so, they need an upfront payment.
Yeah, I mean, in the cold light of day, Graham, that sounds so completely ridiculous as to be laughable.
Ray, I completely agree, but of course these claims are mainly made in the heat of a loss, and the desire for restitution can easily overwhelm common sense. The chance to get your money back can stop rational thinking in its tracks.
As anyone who's listened to or read The Missing Crypto Queen can easily testify.
Well, yes, there's some really sad stories in there. You know, people have encouraged their entire families to invest their savings. It's just anyway. But you're absolutely right. And as you've guessed, the recovery scheme is just another scam, and the mark gets to add in a second loss on top of their first.
And they don't just happen online, do they? There was a documentary some while ago about property rental frauds, for example.
Well, tell me more.
Well, the obvious ones are where a property is listed in a sought-after area at a really competitive rental. So when you inquire, you're told that there's intense competition for the property. So in order to secure it, the landlord or his agent needs a holding deposit from you up front.
What before you've even seen it?
Yeah. And students desperate for university accommodation or someone facing the imminent end of their existing tenancy, who faces, you know, having to leave the area potentially otherwise, can often yield to those sorts of pressures.
And often they're the most financially vulnerable. So that is just crap, isn't it? Horrible. Yeah. You said they were the obvious ones, which suggests, right, that there are other versions of this.
Oh, yes, indeed. There have been cases where people have been able to get hold of the key to a rental property and make a copy. And then they can use the copy to show prospective tenants around, even though they don't have any connection to the apartment at all, and then take a whole series of deposits from everyone who says they want it.
Oh, my word. So what's the answer in this?
Well, one answer is only ever to use registered letting agents. Check them out first. Ring the office to make sure the person showing you around actually works for them. Never pay a deposit until you've seen, agreed and signed a lease, preferably in the agent's office.
Yes, and never forget the old adage, and it became one because it's true. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, exactly.
And I guess, as we've already mentioned in passing, Ray, so we should talk about it, fishing with the PH and its various, you know, vishing and all sorts of subsets.
Well, absolutely. So, I mean, we've become so used to spam filters, keeping most of that away from sight, that it's almost got to the point of becoming a problem again.
Okay, you might just need to explain that.
Well, these days, so little dodgy stuff gets through to our main email accounts and actually appears on screen in front of us, that there's a danger we become less cautious about what does get through.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, it's true. Funnily enough, I rarely do this, but knowing we were recording this episode, I did go and take a trawl through my recent spam emails.
Okay. I'm sure that was educative.
Well, they were certainly trying to educate me, but not maybe in a manner that I really need right now.
Or perhaps ever would. with suitable caution and reluctance, perhaps, I'll invite you to share a couple of examples that might be suitable for a general audience.
Okay, and I did have to look for these.
Yeah.
Well, I had one that wanted to show me a crazy cheap way of removing toenail fungus.
Okay. Have you got toenail fungus, Graham?
No, Ray, I haven't.
Well, not anymore anyway. I mean, that's a fairly highly targeted audience. Or you know, maybe they're thinking, well, it takes no more money to send 10 million of these than it does 10 of them. Let's just, you know, hope that we get it in front of the interested person. But, you know, obviously, if they create enough interest in their title line, who knows who might open the email and get more than they bargained for.
Well, maybe, but I've got to tell you, Ray, it didn't work with me.
No, I'm not altogether surprised. Anything a bit more mainstream than that?
Oh, just for a second, I thought you were going to say anything a bit more midstream.
Well, no. Let's not discuss that type of email, perhaps, Graham.
Well, you did say to sample.
Dear. I think we should move on.
Okay, how about the one telling me that I had won a free power drill?
Well, it's still not terribly exciting, Graham, although they obviously know that your date of birth wouldn't endear you to some of the more exotic offers, perhaps. Well, yeah, are they offering you slippers as well? And funeral plans? Yeah, absolutely. Not terribly exciting. You've got to be able to do better than that.
Well, the one that really amused me is the one telling me that I had been nominated for inclusion in Who's Who.
Oh, yeah. No, I've had that one as well. And when you looked at it?
It was addressed to valued candidates, which doesn't inspire much confidence.
No, I do wonder how many people that takes in. But of course, it doesn't need to take in many, and it's virtually free to send as many as you want.
Exactly. But I tell you what, Ray, do you know what was really noticeable by its absence?
Go on.
Well, any of those amazing emails telling you someone had found several $1 million in a deceased person's account and that you had been selected to help them move it. And for that, you get a big slice of the action.
Now, I still see quite a few of those, actually, when I go and check the spam folder. They're called 419 scams.
Now, why are they called that, Ray?
It's the section of the Nigerian Criminal Code that covers fraud, which tells you all you need to know, really, about where this scam was developed into something of an industry. It's more technically known as advance fee fraud.
And that classification actually includes the example of fraud recovery fraud we gave a minute ago.
But I did want to warn people about a different kind of fraud recovery fraud that we've already mentioned in passing that has caught out some very security-aware people.
Well, I think you should go on and tell us then.
Okay, let's say you get a call from the fraud department of your bank. They establish their bona fides by telling you your date of birth and your postcode or part of it, and maybe take the first and the fourth character of your online banking password from you.
Well, that all sounds pretty reasonable so far.
Yeah, so they then tell you that you've passed security and that they want to check two pending transactions on your account that they think might not be genuine. They'll describe a couple of large transactions for consumer goods at Amazon or another online or physical store, and you'll be horrified and deny all knowledge.
Yeah, that sounds quite likely.
Yeah, so they'll tell you not to worry because they've blocked the transactions and your money is safe.
Hurrah, thank you.
Yeah. But unfortunately, your account's been compromised, clearly, so you need to take urgent action now to safeguard it.
And can the fraud department help me to do that, Ray?
Well, of course they can, Graham. And they've just saved your bacon, as it were, so your defences may well be down to the point that you're happy to share PINs, passwords and authorised payments that you normally wouldn't.
And I'm sure that's how it plays out far too often.
I think so. I'd like to finish off, if I may, with one of my favourite fraud stories. It was one that formed the basis of a Derren Brown show on UK TV.
Is that the horse racing one?
It is, yeah.
Oh, go on then. It's brilliant. So, I love this.
So it starts off with thousands of people receiving an unsolicited email telling them the name of a winner in a forthcoming horse race.
And?
Well, lots of people ignored it, but some at least bothered to check back and see what happened.
And?
Well, it won.
Well.
Yeah. And a while later, they got another email with another recommendation, and that horse won again. Only this time, some of the people thought that, based on the track record, it was worth a flutter.
Well, that's very nice for them.
Yeah, exactly. And then it happened a third time, and it won again. And rather more people had a flutter this time.
Well, I bet they did, but I'm going to be honest, Ray, I'm not seeing the value proposition yet.
Well, the fourth time it happened, the email came with a request. Given the tipster was now three wins out of three tips, the fourth tip was going to cost you a subscription to the service. And it included some bank details to send money to, after which the tip would be forthcoming.
But they'd already won three times, so where's the jeopardy?
Well, the tipster, if we can call him or her that, was choosing races that featured only four horses and sending each of those horses as a win prediction to a quarter of the mailing list. And as long as you start with a suitably big mailing list, you can keep doing that three or four times and you'll still have a substantial population who've only ever seen winning tips.
And in doing so, those people who got the winning tips just might have earned enough money to pay for the next tip without it costing them anything at all, in effect.
Well, yeah, possibly the nearest thing to a victimless crime, except for all the people who were sent losing horses, of course.
Of course, and the bookies who paid out on the winning horses.
Yeah, but the beauty there was nothing illegal about the bet. The fraud happened right at the very end of the scam.
Yeah, which highlights one very important point, right?
Which is what?
Well, the scammers are generally more ingenious, more creative, and more psychologically adept than most people would imagine.
Well, that's true enough, Graham. This is an enemy you underestimate at your peril. I think we should leave it there for today. Where should we go next?
Well, I thought maybe next time, Ray, we should look at some of the tools currently being developed by banks and other financial institutions to help in the fight against fraud.
I'm looking forward to it.